Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in, friends, to the NOLA Drink Show. I do appreciate it this week, as I always do each and every week. Thanks, everyone out there, for being a supporter of the program. Hope everybody out there is as well as they can be. Seem to be saying that quite a bit these days, and I hope everybody's safe, healthy, and, of course, doing what you're supposed to be doing. Also something we've been saying a lot at the top of the show these days, and I'll get back to that in a second. I do hope that everyone had a great Mother's Day out there. I'm sure it was quite a bit different with the social distancing. I hope you were practicing that. But I hope all the moms out there had a good day, as best of a day as they possibly could. And I hope everybody out there, their family, friends, and everyone else also had a good day as well. Happy Mother's Day. Slightly belated to all the moms out there. But yeah, I wanted to mention something here. We got a good show coming up for you here today. I'll say this first. Robert LeBlanc, who is the proprietor of the LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group, joins us. Ro joins us from time to time, as regular listeners know, to talk about the restaurant and hospitality industry, both here in New Orleans, and I think a lot of what we talk about relates to just about anywhere. I always appreciate Ro's honesty and his candor in these conversations. This one's no different. He was on about 6 weeks ago, I think, when all this was first starting, when they first shuttered the restaurants, the stay-at-home order came down, so on and so forth. And I wanted him to come back on this time as we sort of enter what I'm calling Act Two, but kind of bookend, if you will, Act One. He came on at the beginning. This is kind of the end of Act One. I think we all know that we have more to go through this. And so we talk a little bit about the landscape as it exists now, what reopening might look like, some of the things that they're thinking about as a restaurant group, what we might look like in the new normal months down the road, and a whole host of other things. It's a very honest and candid conversation. If you are an enthusiast of the food and drink and restaurant and hospitality scene, and if you aren't, I don't know why the hell you're listening to this show, but if you are, I think you're going to find it very, very interesting on numerous levels. And also, certainly, if you're an industry person, I think you're going to find it interesting as well on different levels. So he is our featured interview and our guest. I did want to mention, friends, I just touched on this, doing what you're supposed to do. These are scary times, right? They continue to be scary times. And as we sort of work to strike that balance between getting our economy going again versus the public health issues that need to be taken into account, we really don't know what we're doing in a lot of ways. I'm not here to talk about epidemiology and things like that. We know there, I personally feel there's a significant lack of testing that gives me a great deal of pause about what it is that we're doing right now. Yes, the economy is taking a beating. Yes, there is a public health emergency. How do we find that balance? Where I'm going with this is, we go to reopen the economy, it is incumbent upon all of us to be good citizens, friends, and neighbors, to play your part and do what you're supposed to do. We're going to be around each other a little bit more, it seems like. Whether that's wise or not, I'm not going to say. But you need to do what you need to do. You need to maintain social distancing. You need to wear a mask when you're out, doing, getting your essentials and things like that. That's not to protect you. That's to protect others. Okay, this isn't about you. This is about all of us. And the quicker that we continue to band together, the quicker that we're going to get ourselves to whatever that new normal may look like, and at least be in a much better place than we're in now. Certainly these measures have worked. It's put us in a better place than we were 4 or 5 weeks ago, just about everywhere, right? So please play your part. Please do what you're supposed to do. Please be a responsible person as we move into these new phases of things. And I will say this, I've been out. My wife and I went out for some exercise yesterday on the lakefront over here in Old Mandeville, across the lake from New Orleans. A lot of people being idiots and not doing COVIDiots and not doing what they're supposed to do. Certainly, I think here in St. Tammany Parish, people have not particularly, on a lot of levels, done a great job taking it seriously. Of course, that's the case everywhere. But this time is critical. This isn't a game, friends. It is about being responsible to you, to your friends, to your family, to your neighbors, and to your community. I implore you, please do what you're supposed to do. Please be responsible. Please be a good citizen. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, and then we're going to be back with our featured interview with Robert LeBlanc of LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group. Come on back.
Dad's been shucking dozens since 42. Iron tub ice down full of Falstaff brew. Black head of son Bobby Charles cold. blue. Catholic church bells toll the Louisiana blues. Oyster rake scraping down Grand Isle Way.
Everybody, welcome back to the program. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks, friends, for listening into the show this week. As always, as you know, pleased to be joined by our featured guest here on the show and my good friend, Robert LeBlanc of LeBlanc Smith Hospitality and Restaurant Group. Ro, how are you, my friend?
Doing well, bud. How are you guys?
We're hanging in there, buddy. Hanging in there. You and I were talking a little bit before we went on the air, kind of catching up on Mother's Day activities and chopping wood in the backyard. Well, you were chopping wood in the backyard, man. I've pretty much been just drinking beers, dude. So I've been doing 12-ounce curls.
Look, I'm jealous. We all have these weird things that have happened as a result of this and being home all day. And what I've found is I'm enjoying chopping down all of the overgrowth in my yard and doing it in the most primitive ways possible. So I'm literally using old-school bow saws to chop trees down and break trees down with my kids. But it's been fun, and it keeps my mind off of things, and it makes me feel like I'm not the pampered 21st century dude that I am. So, yeah, man.
Right on. That's good. That's good. You guys had a good Mother's Day, as we talked about that a little
bit?
We
did. Yeah. We did. Low-key, Danielle and her boys, which was good, and we saw my parents for the first time in a while, so that was fun and touching. But low-key, what about you guys?
Yeah, it was good, man. Thanks. We just had our youngest, my wife, so my youngest stepdaughter of two, who's 25, and she came over, and we made Sylvia dinner, and my lovely wife decided to pick, we're trying to teach the youngest how to cook, right? She's 25, but doesn't really know how to cook particularly well, so I've sort of been showing her how to do different things in the kitchen, and the recipe that Sylvia wanted was this really nice Thai lemongrass beef dish, which turned out to be fairly complex. So it was not the best training ground for an up and coming wannabe home cook and a mildly frustrated husband in the kitchen after a while. But it turned out okay, man. And, you know, a little bit of sake later and a nice meal, and it was good. It was a good day overall. Thanks.
I like that technique. We've learned that the stiffer the drink, the better the food tastes.
Yeah, absolutely, man. That's, you know, it's starting to take a toll, man. I've been joking, you know, I was joking with people when this started that, yeah, I was just going to drink my way through the coronavirus or, you know, a cocktail a day until COVID goes away. That seemed, in hindsight, that's a pretty poor strategy, man. It's not sustainable. It's gone on longer than I thought.
Hey, they thought you were bluffing. I'm glad you proved them wrong.
Well, thanks, man, for coming on today. And what you and I were talking about before we went on the air here, you were on with me, I think, about 6 weeks ago, kind of as all of this was blowing up. This was when the shutdown first occurred, the stay-at-home order occurred. You guys had just shuttered the establishments, the different restaurants and bars that you have in town as part of the group, and we'll get into that. And I wanted to have you back on now because, as I was saying to you, I sort of view this as a bookend thing, but it's sort of a bookend to what I was telling you is Act One. Because we're certainly not done with any of this by any stretch of the imagination. We have this transition here that's coming up really kind of today, tomorrow. For listeners out there, just to clarify again, we're taping this on the morning of Monday, May 11th. So the governor here in Louisiana, if that's where you're listening, hasn't made his announcements of what the next phase might look like. That'll happen this afternoon. But I wanted to have you on because we've kind of gone through this 6 week or so window of Act One and sort of look back on what happened and then kind of where we see things going in Act Two. And I guess I'll start it here, Ro, because I think one of the things that we're anticipating from the governor here in Louisiana, and I think we're seeing similar models, I think this applies to a lot of people around the country and really around the world, is the opportunity, I hate to use that word, the possibility of reopening, but in a much lower capacity. It was speculated maybe 50% capacity in a restaurant or bar, and now I think we're looking at 25%. When everybody's hearing this, at least in Louisiana, they probably know what it is. But, you know, what are your thoughts about that? I know it's a big question, and I'll frame it one last way before I kick it to you. You and I talked in the previous broadcast a bit about how, you know, go food, pick up food, curbside, delivery, all that stuff was great for some, but it wasn't a complete solution really for anyone. And for some people, it was a non-starter, just not economically viable. So how are we feeling about a 25% capacity reopening mandate?
I don't think it's possible at 25%.
For anybody? Do you mean for just pretty much anybody?
If on-site dining is a critical part of your model, I think for the businesses that can make it with delivery and takeout only, then I think the 25% thing is fine because it's a lagniappe. It just allows you to accommodate a little bit more demand. But for businesses like ours that are primarily predicated upon people sitting down and having dinner in the business, 25% doesn't work. There's no way to make that work economically. 50%, I think we can actually make work. We've got to get really lean with how we do things. We've got to simplify the menu. We've got to get lean on steps of service and become a little bit quicker on how we actually produce things and do that with fewer people, which we're going to have to do based on social distancing requirements anyway. Mm-hmm. So 50%, I think we can actually make work. You've got to be creative and think outside of the box, but I think you can make 50% work. 25% you can't make work. And what I'm afraid of, Brian, where I think that's really dangerous, I'd almost rather them just, and this is my opinion, but I'd almost rather them just continue to say, just hold off, because my fear is that too many restaurants are going to rush back too quickly and start to use their PPP money, and they're going to spend the lion's share of that before we're able to actually get open in a sustainable way. And once you need those resources to be able to facilitate normal business, most people will be out of their PPP or out of the joy of their PPP. And I really don't feel that there's going to be a lot more assistance coming from the government. I think maybe one more round, but I don't think it's going to be huge. But I don't think there's a big pot of money coming behind this one.
In the PPP kind of format, I agree with you. I think, you know, you and I were talking off air that maybe we're looking at, you know, you and I are no economists here, politicians, but maybe one more round of some form of stimulus. But on the PPP level, I think there were a couple interesting things to unpack here. You raised the idea, which I think is a very accurate one, that, you know, with social distancing and a lower capacity in the restaurants, you know, as far as seating goes and things like that, you therefore are going to have less people working because there's less need, less demand. How does that play row into the PPP thing? You can't just hire everybody back, right? And then not have 75% or 50% of the people working.
I think the responsibility, the most responsible thing to do with the PPP is to treat it as a loan. Because I think everybody did the best they could with the information they had. And PPP is a great program for most businesses, businesses that are still open or businesses that have been affected economically from the revenue side, don't really need to let people go as long as they have the financial resources to keep them. So for restaurants, that doesn't apply because for restaurants, we need to close down for safety and health reasons. We can't have people in our restaurants. We can't have team members in our restaurants. And so for us, the PPP, the sunset on that is June 30th. So you've got to spend it by June 30th to be forgiven. And the guidelines for forgiveness are generous, but they're not effective if you can't realize any revenue while you were spending that PPP money. So I think the responsible thing for restaurants to do, and what hopefully someone will soon, because the PPP loans, the second round, are being funded now. And so I think someone needs to say, look, we need to think about these things as loans, or the federal government needs to create much more lenient guidelines, forgiveness guidelines. And I think that they did last Monday. I think the number is now closer to 50%. So as long as you hire 50% of the people back and spend 50% of the payroll that you had pre-COVID, you're eligible for forgiveness. But again, the reality of it is if you start spending that too soon when you can't be open and realize revenue in a sustainable way, even if it's forgiven, those are precious resources you're going to need to stay open. And we're encouraging people to spend them before we can realize revenues.
Yeah, and that was the other point that I wanted to get to that you touched on, is that I think that – so, I mean, would your suggestion be maybe for one, two, that we need to extend that deadline past June 30th so that these resources can be parlayed a little bit longer? And especially, you know, let's put a New Orleans lens on this. We know that business is typically, no matter under normal times, business is slow in the summer. So being able to generate revenue and being open isn't necessarily a fix to the situation coming into the months that we're coming into.
Correct. It's a national program, so I want to be careful not to say that we should do these things based on the New Orleans standards.
Sure.
So some restaurants are busiest in the summer. It's not the case for us in New Orleans. But so we have to be careful in that we look at it from a national lens when we make this analysis and assessment. But I feel strongly that if the federal government maintained the guidelines that the money needed to be spent on rent, utilities, and payroll, and the money was only spent in that way, and you made your best effort to hire as many people as you could sustainably hire and pay them as well as you could sustainably pay them, then no matter how long it takes to spend that money, it will be forgiven the same way that it would have been forgiven had you spent it by June 30th.
Right. There you go.
They're doing is they're incentivizing people to maybe spend a little bit less responsibly than they should based on the sustainability of business and levels of sales, just so that people get the loan forgiven. The loan becomes a grant. And obviously a grant is much more valuable monetarily than a loan. But if a grant or the money as a loan is the only resource that you have to buy the time to stay open as long as it takes to get back to normal business levels where you can actually turn out a profit and start repaying the loan, then it's more valuable to us as a loan than it is as a grant.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And I think, and I appreciate what you're saying, is we were talking about this off air too. I mean, no one had the time or the opportunity to figure out every single little city and every single little industry and how this was going to play out. It was a very sort of blunt force instrument here. But, you know, we are looking, as we know, where the rubber hits the road. New Orleans is unique in a lot of ways, and New Orleans is a seasonal town, which is not necessarily unique in a lot of ways. And so, you know, it is our reality here of what this potentially means. I do like your suggestion of what we're talking about there.
Well, there's a real strong lobby going on right now, both National Restaurant Association and the Independent Restaurant Coalition Cooperative. There's a lot of lobby going on. So I do think there will be some relaxed guidelines for the PPP, but I do think we're going to have to spend it primarily on payroll, and we're going to have to spend it on rent and utilities and health insurance. We really need to stick to the guidelines of what they said that we can spend it on. But I think if we do that and we treat it like a loan in the short term, I do think there's a good chance that there will be additional legislation that will ease the guidelines for forgiveness of that loan. But I think we need to be really, really responsible and understand that the money is more important to us in that it gives us the opportunity to buy as much time as we need. But the money is more valuable than a grant, even if it's in a loan form.
Yeah.
For the restaurant industry.
Right. And that's a good point. And now we do maybe have some opportunity to look back in hindsight and even take things on a more case by case basis or situational basis to kind of look at that sort of thing. Cause I think that that's really very important. People need operating capital, right? I mean, and this is sort of,
correct.
Sort of where we're going there with that. Well, let's do this, Ro. Let's go ahead and take a brief break here on the show, and we're going to come back. I want to talk to you a little bit more, kind of what we think the industry is going to look like in a broad sense, and also what we think the industry is going to look like here in New Orleans, because I think it's a lens in many ways, at least to other places as well. You got some time to stick around there, buddy?
Absolutely, man.
All right, cool. Well, friends, what we're going to do, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. We're chatting with Robert LeBlanc, who is the proprietor of LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group, a very fine hospitality and restaurant group here in New Orleans that has several properties, and we'll probably talk about those in a little while as well, getting his thoughts here on the industry, tourism, hospitality, and all that good stuff. We'll take a little break here, friends. Come on back.
Understand just what I mean.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We are chatting with my good friend Robert LeBlanc from LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group. And, Ro, you know, we all know, and New Orleans is, as I said in the last segment, New Orleans is unique in some ways, but being a seasonal and tourism-driven town, we have lots of those on the planet and around the country. And, you know, so our model and our look and our feel and how we're affected by this is quite a bit different than some people, but somewhat the same as others. But we know that tourism is, and hospitality are our biggest economy here in New Orleans. So I think anywhere that that you have a restaurant industry and hospitality industry, which is pretty much everywhere, has been affected. But in places like New Orleans, the effect is drastic. We had our best tourism year to date in 2019. The estimates, if I'm not mistaken, were something like a 19.75 million people visited in 2019, and the visitor spending was somewhere around $10 billion. That's the official estimate. It's important economically and it's important culturally, but you know, I think a lot of people are speculating that it's also ironically is going to be probably one of the slowest, if not the slowest industries to bounce back from all of this, just because of the nature of what the industry is. And then the dynamics of people not wanting to travel and all kinds of other things. What are some of your thoughts about that? You know, in a broad sense and what it means to us here in our backyard.
I think it's the brutal facts, Brian, are that it's going to be really gnarly for a long time. It's interesting. Obviously, tourism is our primary industry, and the port is probably secondary. And I could be wrong on that. It's port / oil, but oil's up there. Oil's a significant part of the industry.
And sure.
As you guys know, oil is getting crushed too, getting devastated as well. So I think we're facing a little bit of a tsunami at the exact same time that we're facing an earthquake a bit. The other thing that happens from a secondary standpoint is we don't give enough credit to the fact that the hospitality industry here in New Orleans is obviously supported by tourism, but it's also really supported additionally and held up by the hospitality industry itself. In other words, the biggest fans of bars and restaurants are people who work in bars and restaurants. So when we talk about the local economy and locals, everybody talks about locals going into bars and restaurants, and locals love to dine here in New Orleans. That's absolutely true. But a big part of the local dining base are people who work within the hospitality industry, people who work at hotels, restaurants, people who service hotels and restaurants. So I think the circumstances in the future is pretty grim and it's pretty dire. And it's strange because I, despite that, have a pretty optimistic outlook about how we can survive and we will thrive. And I do want to spread more of a position of belief and optimism, but I'm a big believer in facing the brutal facts. And the brutal facts are it's going to be really hard. We are going to have a very difficult time recovering in our industry in particular, not just because of tourism being down, but convention business is basically non-existent. Oil industry is basically non-existent at this point. And the secondary support that we get from other peers in hospitality is basically going to be non-existent.
Right.
So now look, the other side where I think we have some opportunities are, I think we will see, we'll probably see more people who appreciate bars and restaurants for what they are. And they might go there a little bit more frequently now because everyone appreciates most that, which is what they almost lost. And so I think people feel that sense of loss these last 2 months. I think we also have an opportunity with more people working remotely.
Let me ask you, because I want to ask you a question on that point, if you don't mind holding that thought for a second.
Yep.
Because you said something that I thought was very insightful, potentially, last time that you were on, is this idea that, you know, we're going to rediscover, for lack of a better way to put it, the joys of staying at home. We've readjusted our daily routine. It does not really, you know, obviously does not include going out to restaurant and bars and that sort of new normal that people will be living in. There's got to be a push and a pull to what you just said, right? We miss it. We really want it. I know I miss it and I really want it. But, you know, I think the push or the pull, whichever way you want to look at it, possibly in another direction, is people are going to be like, well, I think about all the money that I didn't spend over the past 6 weeks. That looks pretty good. Maybe I cut it in half moving forward.
No doubt that's going to happen. I think people will spend less, but I think people will spend less per visit, but they may visit more frequently,
okay,
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So if we can figure out how to make our menus and our menu prices slightly less expensive, slightly more affordable, and create experiences that people can pop into and out of and enjoy for 30 or 45 minutes, maybe an hour, as opposed to 1 hour 45 to 2 hours and 30 minutes. that you see a lot of times in turn times with people.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of people spending maybe $60 a head at restaurants, if we can get them comfortable and create a great experience at $30 or $35 a head, which you might see, what I think we will see, what I'm optimistic that we'll see, or I'm hopeful, is more people working remotely are still want a third place. They still want some place that's not their home, it's not their office. And I think that restaurants and bars can be those places. I think it looks a little bit closer to an all-day cafe model than a traditional grand dame restaurant with tasting menus. There's always going to be a market for that. People are always going to want that. But I think when we talk about the aggregate of the restaurant industry, we need to start orienting towards less expensive, more comfortable experiences that can still express a sense of hospitality that people might engage more frequently than they did prior, but less intensely in terms of the time spent on site and the money spent on site. Mm-hmm. And I think we can do that. And from a tourism standpoint, you're going to see what I read an interesting article this weekend. The speculation was it's going to be a little bit like it was in the 70s. And I think they're probably right. And I know that our family is planning on traveling this way. You're going to see a lot more road trips. So New Orleans is the most interesting, most European city within a 6-7 hour drive of tons of huge metropolitan areas.
Mm-hmm.
Houston, Memphis, Nashville's a little bit longer, it's 8, Atlanta, Mobile. So I think we have the potential to see a lot of people who come to New Orleans just by kind of hopping in the car. And when you start looking at the state of Louisiana, then Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, Texas, particularly East Texas, it's a pretty strong population that looks to come to New Orleans. So if we can be an appealing destination for people, particularly in the drive-in market, we might have an opportunity to pick up some really strong leisure travel, leisure tourism as well.
Do you think, because that's a really interesting point, and you and I have talked about this over the past few years, where I think a lot of the tourism landscape here has changed, and we used to be really dead in the summer, and then I think in recent years we've started to see more budget regional car travelers, like we're talking about to a degree in the summer months coming down because, you know, hotel deals and things. So but what we would always talk about, you and I, was that it was still good to have more people in the city, but for a lot of like establishments like yours, it didn't really change things because that was not the type of place that they were patronizing. So are we kind of thinking that we're looking at that sort of summertime model, but people from slightly different economic backgrounds with maybe a little bit more affluence are going to be borrowing that short trip, car trip model, and here for 3 days, want to experience a bunch of stuff and then get out of Dodge?
Yeah. Yeah, because I think that a lot of people that we wouldn't have put in that category 2 months ago will be in that category as a result of the economy being so bad.
Right.
And I think also, that's just going to be the way that people want to travel. And I think people, even people we would consider affluent, are going to be a little bit more mindful of how they spend their money. And they're going to want to stretch dollars a little bit further. And I think as an industry, what that's going to require us to do, we've always been super judgmental and super righteous about that. And we always stand on the pillar of creativity and artistic experience and artistic influence. And, you know, frankly, that's kind of fits crap. I don't know if I can curse. If I could curse, I'd say, hopefully you can edit that out. But, you know, so we're going to have to figure out how to be inspired and create these inspiring experiences, but doing it in a way that might be more accessible in terms of approach and feel and affordability for people, because people just got knocked on their ass.
Right.
And if you say that you're in hospitality because you really love feeding people and taking care of people and nurturing people, then that should be universal. It shouldn't be conditional based on people being above a certain income level or people being willing to spend a certain amount of disposable income.
Right.
It should be universal.
Absolutely.
So we always talk about how creative we are. We all talk about how visionary we are. We have to find a creative way to inspire people through hospitality experiences and offer really great food, great cocktails, great wine, great service. We've got to do it in a way that people can afford to approach.
Yep, I agree. Let's do this, Real. Let's take a quick break here on the show, and we'll come right back. You hang out for a second?
Perfect. Yep.
Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
Get in the groove and let the good times roll. We're going to stay here to soothe our soul. The taste.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in, friends, to the NOLA Drink Show this week. I appreciate it, as always. chatting with my good friend Robert LeBlanc, proprietor of LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group. And Ro, one of the things I wanted to ask you here before we close out the radio portion of the show, I will note to listeners that you're sticking around for another shot with NOLA Drinks, our podcast only thing, and we're going to get into more of that. So if you are listening on the radio, be sure to go to noladrinks.com. But a lot of stuff, Ro, that people are talking about and looking different, experts and policy people, politicians, economists that look at the hospitality and tourism industry, you know, both here in New Orleans as well as in a broader expanse, varying degrees of when we can sort of think we might be back to economic levels that look like what we had prior to the COVID-19 crisis. And, you know, so for example, Stephen Perry, who's the CEO and president of New Orleans and Company, which is our tourism and visitors and convention bureau here in town, his view is, I think, you know, maybe, and it was, I think he's being optimistic, admittedly so, but, you know, maybe by the end of 2022, we start to kind of, it's going to look very different, but the numbers, the, you know, the economic impact and revenue and so on might be about where it was before all this happened. And then I'm, you know, other people are saying 4 years, 5 years. There was one economist locally from one of the universities that said, look, after Katrina, it took us 10 years to have hotel booking occupancy rates get up to where they were before. What is your feeling? And I know this is all just sort of gut kind of stuff and anecdotal, but how do you feel about these? You know, some people are talking a year and a half and some people are talking a decade.
So the way that we're looking at it, I don't have enough information. I'm also not, you know, I'm not naive enough to say that I know exactly when it's going to
come
back.
Sure, absolutely.
For us to try to pin it on a specific time by which we think it will come back will be very, could be very dangerous for restaurateurs. So what we think about is we make decisions based on the facts that are known and knowable. And so what we know today is it's going to be brutal. And what we are planning to do is to design business models that will allow us to be profitable and sustainable while compensating people well and treating people well on 50% of the sales that we were doing on an annual basis pre-COVID. And so we've got to look at our entire business model and re-engineer our entire business model to make that work and sustainable. And if we can do that, then we feel like we are going to be okay and solid in the short term. And sure, we'll make more money in the long term when things do come back, however gradual that may be. But I think you get into a dangerous predicament if you start trying to identify, you know, I know people are saying, oh, it's going to be back to normal at the end of the year, or we'll get back to the same revenues we were doing in 2019. We'll get back to those by Mardi Gras 2021. I think it's really dangerous to sort of create false hope and to make decisions based on timelines that we really have no clue, and we don't have enough information to truly know how to make those decisions and those estimates. So I think the responsible thing to do is to make decisions based on what we know in the short term, and that is that it's going to be really difficult. And if you can figure out how to make your business work on 50% of the sales, and there are ways to do that, I think you're probably going to be okay. And then as the tide rises and your boat rises with it, you'll probably generate more revenue, more profitability. You'll be able to hire more people and pursue more projects then. But I think right now, all we're focusing on is the next 3 months. And we think about things in kind of 3 month cycles, 3 month periods. So
that makes sense.
We're anticipating, frankly, Brian, we think we'll do 40% of the revenues that we did. Let's say we open June 1. We'll do 40% of the revenues in June 2020 that we did in June 2019.
Wow, right. And we know June.
And we've got to make that work.
Yeah, and June's a slow month. It's the start of the slower months, right? I mean, it's not as bad as some. Well, so I think that's a really good point. I think a lot of this, and I definitely did not want to pin you down because this is all just, you know, throwing darts here or throwing spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks as far as any sort of estimates go. I just find it very interesting that because we don't know. The spread is really everywhere. It's all across the map of what it might mean. But I think your take-home point here was that people need to adjust their business models to adapt to what's actually going on in the short term. And if they do that successfully, then that might actually speed things up. If people keep hoping that it's just going to go back to the way it was within 6 months or 12 months, probably not realistic, and it's not survivable. Is that, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that what you're saying?
You're 100%. Yes, you're correct. And you know that I'm an optimist, but I feel like in this situation, it's unfair to ourselves. It's unfair to our teams. It's unfair to our community to be anything less than realistic. And if now's the time, if people don't feel like they can or they're willing to look at their business model, to innovate, to create a brand new model that will work and will be sustainable on 40 or 50% of their historic sales, then they may need to think about not reopening. Because if they, what we've been through has been painful enough to go through all of the pressure, the anxiety, the stress, and the sacrifice of, and the liability of reopening only to close down 2 or 3 months later, like that, you'll break people even further than they've already been broken. And so I think we need to have these honest conversations in the industry. It's not coming back the way that it was. It's not, we're not buying time for 3 months of a rough summer. And then when the Saints and the LSU Tigers start playing again, we're back to normal. It's not, there is no new normal for a very long time.
Right. Do you think, and since you brought it up, you and I have had this conversation over the past few years on the show, as we usually do, talking about the industry. And we always, here in New Orleans in particular, you know, we always lose a lot of restaurants over the summer because it's slow. A lot of people just don't have the heart to keep it up, even if they're somewhat viable. You know, so, I mean, there's all kinds of different reasons. The slow season is only kind of one of them, and it also, you know, the actual numbers, but it creates a break, and that's when people might choose to kind of throw in the towel. Have you heard anything from some of your peers, and obviously not naming names or anything? Are we going to lose a hell of a lot more restaurants, even with some of I mean, you think a lot of people are just, they've already thrown in the towel, essentially.
I think we'll lose a ton from people just saying, look, it's not worth it to reopen. And we'll lose even more from people reopening under the expectation that it's going to be exactly like it was, or just not being really conservative with their cash resources. Just having false expectations of what's going to happen. And so I think we'll lose a lot. And I'm not talking to other people. I want to be real careful. I want to be helpful. I want to share what we know. I've actually enjoyed, Nina Compton and I have spoken a good bit. I've spoken to Neil Bodenheimer a good bit. I've been talking with Natalie Jordy a lot. I really enjoyed those relationships and brainstorming, strategizing. So we don't talk about who's opening, who's not opening. I want to make sure that I'm helping as many people as possible and not creating this negative context of what the future is. But so I don't know who's closing, but I do know that we went back out to our team. LeBron Smith has about 150 people, 170 people in total. We got our PPP loans funded last week. So we talked to the team a little bit, but not so much because we had no idea if we'd even be able to reopen everything because we hadn't at that point gotten any loans or any support or any assistance to reopen. And we have some resources to reopen, maybe one or two without any assistance, but we didn't have enough to reopen all of them. So as soon as we found out that we got the PPP loans, we went back out to our entire team with an all-team email to gauge who was interested in coming back, because that's the second part of it. We need to figure out how to staff these things and how to align the number of people who want jobs back with the available jobs. And it doesn't really surprise me. I'm not shocked. We were in business prior to Katrina. The same thing happened to us in Katrina. But, Brian, less than 40% of the people, and you know that we at LeBron Smith, our pride was always the people that we had. I mean, almost everybody that we had was amazing. And we had very good relationships with them. And these are people that I know intimately well and still text on a weekly basis. And a lot of those people aren't coming back. And it's not a hard feelings thing. It's just, look, I've evacuated back home near where my parents are, and if we go through these shutdowns or these quarantines in the fall, it's easier to do that near family where we can pool resources. Or, you know, I've been writing a lot more and I'm just not really interested in getting back into hospitality at this point, or I'm going to take a look at going to grad school. People just, these things force people to reassess
where they are. Yeah, Ro, do me a favor.
Where they are,
we got about 45 seconds left before I need to close out the radio portion of the show. Tell people where they can find LeBlanc Smith, and you and I are going to continue the conversation on the podcast, but where do we find y'all online?
LeBlancSmith.com will lead you to all the venues, so that's the easiest way to do it. And I'm on Instagram at RobertLeBlanc.com, just Robert LeBlanc on Instagram, and that's primarily where we're kind of doing most of our stuff. Each of the venues, which you'll see, has a Facebook page and Twitter. Instagram.
Cool. All right, man. You're going to stick around for another shot with Nola Drinks. Friends, if you're listening on the radio, go get the podcast, NolaDrinks.com, and you'll hear our conversation that continues there. If you are listening on the radio, friends, now especially more than ever, be kind to one another. As always, use your turn signal. And until next time, cheers, y'all. All right, everybody. I hope you're enjoying the conversation that we are having with Robert LeBlanc. I always thank him for his time. Good show this week. And we're going to continue the conversation with him in just a second. Here we go. All right, everybody, up another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. As you know, we're chatting with Robert LeBlanc of LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group, a very fine hospitality organization here in the New Orleans area. And Ro, we were talking before we closed out the radio portion of the show. Importantly, your next step was to go back and talk to the team, everybody, the whole shooting match, and get that sense. I'm actually pretty shocked to hear. I'm not surprised to hear that the number is not anywhere near 100%, but only 40% is a... That's a drastic number, man. I would have guessed much higher. And I think it's interesting what you said. But let me ask you this, because we know, this will be sort of a long question, but we know prior to this situation that we actually had, in some areas of the restaurant and hospitality industry, a shortage, right, of talent and things in kind of in a broad view. And we also have a pretty high unemployment level, obviously, in New Orleans. And I think people were creating some interesting programs to try and bridge those gaps, take underprivileged, underserved youth in the city, give them the proper skills and ability to move into the hospitality industry and maybe meet some of that need. I know this is hard to kind of predict too, but when you mentioned, say, 40%, where do you think supply and demand is going to fall here as far as labor goes as we move forward in these next few months?
I think you're probably going to be able to easily retain your higher end salary positions, your leadership positions. I think it's going to be really hard to retain some of the least compensated people in the organization. And I think supply and demand is going to probably be, if I had to guess, that 40% number of people that want to come back, that's probably going to be about what staffing levels will and can be at restaurants. And that might be a pretty honest and reflective numbers of restaurants that are currently open today or restaurants that were open in February of 2020 that may still be open in October of 2020. So,
It's interesting because I've wondered, it's a sort of blunt force thing. And we're obviously people have lost jobs, people moving away still have to presumably go find work wherever they go. So we're kind of talking about it on a microeconomic level here in New Orleans. But, I did start to wonder, like, will these numbers maybe even kind of line up in a way that works? That's interesting. It's a lot of gross speculation, and people are still, to use your term, we were talking about off air, people are still going to get caught in the crossfire here, though, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, but I do think there's a dynamic that anyone who is interested and willing to work and willing to learn, and any hospitality owner that's willing to invest in people, not just financially, but also developmentally, I think we'll be okay. I think that will fit. But I think it's going to take a little while for those matches to find each other.
Mm-hmm. That's probably a good way to look at it, especially since when we look at good chunk of the culinary talent to a degree, certainly a lot of the bartending talent and the server talent, a lot of the front of house people in certain parts of the kitchen are people that are not from New Orleans. They moved here a year or two ago, and I'm assuming those are a lot of the people that have probably moved back, right, or have gone back to where they came from.
And a lot of these people, most of these people we talk to and we know them intimately well, we've always had a really strong culture. And so people have been really honest as to why they're not coming back. And they make total sense and it's completely logical. And for our part, what we're trying to do is we're not trying to talk anybody into coming back. We want people to come back to be completely willing, because it's going to be so different in the future that we're going to have people who are willing to lean in all the way and help guide what the future of the restaurant business model looks like. Mm-hmm. So if we have to talk you into coming back, that's not good for you. It's not good for us, because it really is an uncertain future. And so people who aren't coming back, it's all for very understandable reasons. People are changing industries. People are staying back in their hometowns closer to family, so that if they've got a shelter in place or hunker down, or, you know, God forbid, if jobs are tight, you know, it's a little bit easier when you're near your parents and you can sneak over to your parents' house for a home cooked meal two or three times a week. And all realistic, understandable reasons. There wasn't many people that didn't want to come back because of some degree of animosity toward us as a company. I mean, almost none of that. Some people have a little level of frustration with the industry, rightfully so, as they should. But for the most part, it's really logical reasons that make a whole lot of sense to us.
How are you guys as a company talking about balancing? Because I'm sure a lot of people are also skittish about safety, right? Both for, you know, for the team as well as for customers and things like that. Nobody really knows what the hell's going on that level either. And so how are you, what type of conversations are you guys having to balance that out as it relates to the team, but also as it, how it relates to the hospitality you're going to provide to your guests?
So I think the safety standards, I think that's a paradigm shift that's going to have to be absolute going forward. So when we design the model, what we're doing is we're designing safety protocols that are not things that we intend to have in place just for the next 3 months. And then when they find a vaccine or a therapeutic treatment program for this virus, then we go back to business as usual. So I think you'll see a lot of the social distancing stuff and a lot of the protective measures that we're putting in place for the team. Those are going to be permanent changes for us. So that's one thing that we're doing. Secondly, what we're trying to do is we're trying to devise the most stringent and the best of all the guidelines. So we're not just taking the guidelines published by the LRA. We're looking at guidelines and best practices across different industries and picking up the things that make sense. And then the last thing that we're saying, and I want to use Maggie Morgan. I had a call with Maggie Morgan from Jewel of the South this morning. She used a word that was great. It's called parlor tricks, which is things that just give the appearance of safety, or things that are done as theater to make people feel safe, but they don't actually create safety and they don't really believe it. So that's the last thing we're doing, is we're trying to figure out the best way to eliminate any and all parlor tricks in the industry. And for us, an example of that would be gloves. You know, they're going to make us, health and safety is going to make everybody in the restaurant wear gloves. Well, there's nothing worse than someone from a culinary standpoint having to wear rubber latex gloves. They're handling heat. Right. They're touching different things that cross-contaminate. It's much safer for them, and it's much safer for the guests, for those people working in the kitchen, not to wear gloves, so that they can use hand sanitizer and they can wash their hands frequently, but they can also stick their hand in an oven without a rubber latex glove on, or grab a hot pan that skin can handle but a rubber latex glove can't handle. So there's just things like that we're working through, where we're trying to use science and use best practices, not just popular practices.
Well, that's a great point. I appreciate that. And let me add, because it kind of dovetails to something you and I were talking about off the air, on the level of guidance, right? I think we're seeing a very disjointed, and I don't mean this just for hospitality, and I don't just mean that here in Louisiana or in New Orleans. We're seeing a very disjointed response to guidance. And so it's a lot of kind of haphazard approaches to things, and then we're making these decisions to reopen the economy, to use that term, in a lot of different places, in a lot of different sectors of the economy. But what we're not, aside from the lack of testing, which we won't talk about on this show, but the actual guidance of best practices to roll these things out. So it sounds like what you're telling me, Ro, is that you guys are, as any good business owner would do, it's incumbent upon yourself to do your due diligence, but you guys are actually kind of developing this on your own. Is that because you're not getting a lot of good guidance and good information and advice and things like that?
We are getting guidance. We're getting advice. Again, back to that idea of people doing the best they can. I think people are trying. I just don't think people making these recommendations just don't think, or they're not, you know, they're just not thinking things all the way through.
No, that's not my implication.
I don't think it's there. I mean, I don't think it's there in as logical a format as it needs to be. Again, I think people are overwhelmed and people are rushed and they're doing the best they can given really taxing circumstances. But the byproduct of that is there's not a whole lot of thought. And frankly, there hasn't been a lot of conversation from people working in the front lines. I mean, if you just talk to a line cook and said, hey, what's it like for you if you wear latex gloves all day in the kitchen? They'd be like, yeah, it's the worst idea ever. You can't wash your hands with a latex glove. And so when we touch that piece of raw chicken, and then we've got to go finish a plate because the chef is on the floor talking to someone, you know, you essentially have raw chicken on your latex gloves that just finished a salad because you didn't wash, because you can't wash with latex gloves. Mm-hmm. So they'd also tell you that, you know, grabbing a hot pan with a latex glove is pretty, a lot more dangerous than getting, you know.
Right.
It's a lot more dangerous than not. So just some logical aspects of that are frustrating. You know, another thing is that the idea of contact tracing. Obviously, contact tracing is important, but we can do that much more effectively and efficiently with technology. So you can, we know if you and Sylvia go to dinner at one of our spots and you swipe your credit card, we know that you were at Sylvain that night. Right. So if it comes to light that someone at Sylvain had coronavirus the night you guys were there, it's really easy for us to use technology to both identify and to contact everyone who was in the restaurant that night, mm-hmm. to make them aware they may need to self-quarantine for 14 days. That's a whole lot easier and more manageable and more sustainable, particularly when you're talking about less manpower, than having someone fill out a legal waiver, which indicates that they were there and just makes people feel completely nervous and uncomfortable because you have no idea what you're signing. So,
yeah, right.
Just things like that. So, you know, I think people are doing the best they can. I just don't think it's all well thought out.
Right.
And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to think about the best practical and most safest solutions we can come up with, and then to make those permanent. So these are permanent solutions. These aren't things that we're going to do for 3 months. So identifying things that we can do that are long-term sustainable.
Okay.
Again, I think this does create a paradigm shift. There's a new normal in how we have to handle ourselves, have to handle guests, how guests want their food and their drinks to be handled going forward.
Right. Let me ask you one last question, Ro, before I let you go, unless there's something else that you want to add, which you're more than welcome to. These are not, we're in a situation where, you know, whether you all are allowed to reopen, you know, as soon as maybe the 16th or, you know, the 1st of June, something like that, which is possible in a limited capacity. This is not a turnkey situation, is it, right? I mean, there's got to be a steep uphill climb that you all are facing. You're talking about you need to staff. You need to figure out who's still here, who's coming back. You need to bring product back in. You need to do all kinds of things. So there's a huge amount of legwork. It's not like you can all of a sudden just throw the doors open and say, well, we can only take 50% of you, but all 50% of you standing outside, come on in. There's a lot more that's got to go into this, and that's got to be a huge challenge, I'm guessing.
It is. We're treating this as relaunching all of our businesses for the first time. So this is like opening for us, like opening 5 spots within the same 2 weeks. It's an incredibly daunting challenge, nearly impossible challenge. But everybody's going through the same things, and this is the reality of the circumstances. And so you just make your decisions. You move forward based on the facts that are both known and knowable, and you do the best you can. You know, the other thing that I think we all need to realize is that I think that everyone, team members, guests, everyone is going to be understanding and forgiving. So if we take some chances on some things and we don't get it exactly right at first, that's okay, as long as we care to make it right. So I think, yes, it will be challenging, and it's also going to have to be adaptive, because you're going to learn a lot in the first week that you're open.
Right.
And it's new reality, and you're going to have to be prepared to adapt for it.
You know, maybe one good thing out of that too, Rose, is we do come into the summer months, then when we know it's typically a little less tourism action, and, you know, you all depend on the locals in many instances, and you guys are no exception. The locals are really, really important during the low season months. That's probably your most forgiving audience, and for the most part, right? So those are almost the people that you can kind of get away with guinea pigging and are going to be the most forgiving, and they're just going to be happy to see you because they're your neighbors and your friends.
Yeah, and there's going to be a lot of magical experiences. For any of us who are here right at the Katrina, you remember the magic of a neighbor coming over and working the front desk of a restaurant because we didn't have enough staff to pull that off, or people in the neighborhood jumping from the bar and helping to bus tables or run food or serve, even in some situations, for their favorite restaurant because people were understaffed and things. So there's going to be a lot of cool and fun expressions of hospitality and camaraderie. And, you know, there's a lot of magic that's going to happen. It's just going to be tough, and we got to stick together. And as grim as the circumstances might be, it's going to be the optimists and the innovators that are going to really thrive. And so to the degree that we all can, we need to really think about approaching this with a sense of optimism and opportunity instead of despair.
Yeah. Good one, man. Well said. Well, unless you have something else, dude, let's go ahead and leave it there. And I would just ask you one more time. We had to rush through it when we closed out the radio portion of the show. Tell people how they can name the properties this time, because we have time, and how everybody can find them online and when they can find you on the street, which is, you know, ideally sooner than later.
Yeah. So we have a Blondsmith, which is Sylvain Barrel Proof Mobar Cabin, Longway Tavern. We You can find us at www.leblancandsmith.com. That'll direct you to all the venues and all the venues' Facebooks, websites, and Instagrams. And we don't know exactly when we're going to open. It's a function of us getting the team back, working on a really innovative model that we'll have to train people on. But we do know that we're not even going to start looking to open until we can allow 50% capacity at our restaurants. Mm-hmm. We think we can make it work at 50% capacity. There's no way we can make it work at 25.
Gotcha. Cool. I appreciate it. And we'll keep everybody posted on what you're up to. Ro, I really appreciate your time, buddy. It's a pleasure to talk to you as always. This is the longest stretch in my life I've gone without seeing you in person. So I'm starting to hurt, man.
I know. It sucks. See you though, buddy. See you. I'm glad. Always glad to talk to you, man. I love you guys. I love you. I appreciate everything you do for our industry.
Likewise. I appreciate you, man. And I hope to see you in person soon. And we'll do this again when we get ourselves into Act Two. How's that?
You won't be able to get rid of me. I might be like Matt Damon's character and you, me, and Dupree. I might just live in the back house.
Yeah, perfect, man. I'll teach you how to work the board because I can barely do it myself.
Good.
Here in the home studio. All right, friends. Hey, we're going to take a brief musical interlude and I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the NOLA Drink Show, friends. I do appreciate it this week, as always. Hey, something I was talking about, you know, at the top of the show, and I've been talking about it at the beginning of the show. This is our parting shot, by the way. I've been talking about it at the beginning of the show quite a bit, is, you know, doing what you're supposed to do. I'm greatly concerned, as I think many of us out there are currently, by what I'm seeing. Now, we all want to reopen the economy. We all want to start to get back to some sense of normal. I understand all of that. But this isn't just a free-for-all, and I'm starting to see people take it like it's a free-for-all. You need to continue to do what you're supposed to do, and this is part of being, as I said at the top of the show, a good citizen, a good neighbor. This really isn't about you. This is about protecting others. What I'm talking about is wearing a mask, maintaining social distancing, staying in small groups, all washing your hands, all the things that you're supposed to do to help this situation ameliorate as quickly as possible. You have to stop. If you're getting examples and taking a lead from the White House, I'm sorry. That's just the wrong place to look. The moron in chief has no idea what he's doing. He has bumbled this from the beginning. Frankly, I don't particularly care if you choose to disagree with that. That really, the facts speak for themselves. And let me put it this way. This attitude that I'm seeing from a lot of people out there who are not taking these things seriously are reflective of what we were seeing in the White House, right? Because nobody was wearing a mask. Trump doesn't want to wear a mask because he thinks it makes him look weak or something, taking a page right out of the Kim Jong-un playbook, which is not really that surprising. But then all of a sudden, the minute that COVID-19 rears its ugly head in the White House, what's going on? Everyone has to wear a mask. So it's hypocrisy at its finest, certainly not setting a good example, certainly not taking it seriously until it's in your backyard. And frankly, that's my point, is a lot of us have been touched by this, and I hear people sometimes say, well, everyone's been touched by this now, so we should be taking it seriously. But frankly, a lot of us really haven't been touched by this, or not touched by this in a way that have been tragic, not in your backyard. So if that's the reason why you're not taking it seriously, all it takes is one trip to the grocery store. All it takes is one jackass situation where you're out partying with 50 people to put it right in your backyard. So do what you're supposed to do. Don't gather in groups like that. Please wear a mask. Please wash your hands. Please be respectful. Do this for others. This isn't about you. This is about our society and our culture. And whether you want to believe it or not, I don't care if your political beliefs make you think otherwise, we are all tied together in this community, no matter what your viewpoint is, no matter who you are. So you have to behave like it. Don't expect the rest of us to do it and then the rules don't apply to you. Because if you play it that way, friends, then it's going to end up in your backyard. And frankly, I'm getting tired of hearing people who didn't think it was in their backyard, then it's in their backyard, and then they're sorry. Just do what you're supposed to do, friends, and we'll get through this so much sooner than we would otherwise. Friends, be safe out there. That's our parting shot. Here's to you.